The dinner this evening will be at 5:30. We'd like to invite you then to be here at that time. And then following that, the film will be shown. And Until I Die is the title of the film. The lady, doctor, who has done the research and is doing the speaking in the film, having to do with death and people who are dying, is well known throughout the United States for her accomplishments and her research in this field. It's not a particularly Christian presentation at that point, although I do believe she comments on the fact that people with religion seem to have something to fall back on that others don't have. However, immediately following the showing of the film, there will be the reactor panel, and at that time there will be those who will be speaking to you about the Christian answer to the subject of death. And what is it that the Christian has to say on this subject? It's for this reason also that I'm speaking to you out of the Word on this subject this morning. 1 Corinthians 15, beginning verses 53 and 54, just the two verses there. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. Very confident words. This mortal shall have put on immortality. How do you put on immortality? What's involved in that, and what else has God had to say about that? If a man die, shall he live again? That's a question that God didn't wait for us to ask. God had Job ask that question a good many years ago. Linguistically speaking, as far as we can date the books, probably the book of Job is the oldest. If a man die, shall he live again? That's a question that plagues every one of us. And every time we see a person die, that question comes back. And Gladys Hunt, in her book on death, tells how the Trapp family, Sound of Music, was on tour in California, and all of them were there except the one who was back in one of the New England states awaiting the birth of their baby. And as they moved into the motel at this one particular place there in California, there was a notice that they were to call a certain number back in the village where they had left her. And they called, and the baby had been taken dead. And then as she was coming out from under the anesthetic, she died. And in the book, Mrs. Trapp is telling about the grief of that close-knit family, and about how they wanted to find some answer. And so they divided the whole Bible up. They gave to the father the Old Testament, and then all the rest of them divided up the New Testament, each one certain books. And as they came back together, they were amazed to find out how much God had said on this subject. And the alternative is not very bright. Thomas Huxley, the great agnostic, had these words written on his tomb: "And if there be no meeting past the grave, if all is silence, darkness, yet 'tis rest, be not afraid, ye waiting hearts that weep, for God still giveth his beloved sleep. And if an endless sleep he wills, so best." We don't buy that idea of death as being an endless sleep, a rest, a silence, and darkness. Maybe it is true that the earth has more graves in it, more dead people than living. Maybe that is true. Maybe they do outnumber us. But still, we don't buy the idea that death ends all. There are four reasonings that are interesting to play with for a little bit along these lines. Because we can thank God. The very idea that God is in her mind, the very idea of God. And even the agnostic Huxley, in this case here, knows that if there's a God at all, he's a God who does not die. It's interesting to find the agnostic, after all he had said in his lifetime, coming up with this kind of a reverence about God. It's as though he'd been driven to it. At the point where he was confronted by death, he couldn't get away from it. And it had to show up in his epitaph, if nowhere else, and he wrote it. If there's a God at all, he's not the kind who dies. He's alive. He goes on living. Nothing about the dog or the cat or the other animal. Nothing to indicate that they have any thoughts concerning a life after death. And it's always been God's way to provide the means when there's an instinct in that direction. The bird has an instinct to fly and a wing to do it with. The fish has an instinct to swim and a fin to do it with. The ear is made for hearing and the eye is made for seeing. And since God made us able to think Him and to think life after death, that's some indication that there could be. In Ecclesiastes, God said, He hath made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He hath set eternity in their heart. Another interesting little reasoning involved here is because in our minds, faith in God is tightly connected with a sense of justice, right and wrong. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? If there's God at all, there must be some kind of a right and wrong. God made us moral creatures. Virtues must be rewarded. Vices must be punished. And since we do not see that justice completed here on earth, then there must be something that goes on after life on earth. Elijah and Jezebel, John the Baptist and Herodias, the Apostle Paul and Nero, surely they're not going to wind up all in the same place on exactly the same level. Surely there must be some differences. A third line of reasoning here, a third reason, because there's so much unfinished life. You know what Jesus said to the unemployed? That's the text for the unemployed, Matthew 20 and verse 7. No man hath hired us, is what they said, a text for the unemployed. No man hath hired us. And that's the life record of some men. They have the ability. They might have swayed the rod of an empire. But somehow or other, they sort of got lost in the shuffle. Their potential was never realized. Gray's Elegy in the Country Churchyard is another example of that. Cut off in the prime of life. Bronhoma. Bronhoma. The potential on earth was never really completed. And even those who live to be a ripe old age. Victor Hugo, on his 70th birthday, wrote as follows: Winter is upon my head, but eternal spring is in my heart. The nearer I approach the end, the plainer I hear aroused in me the immortal symphonies of the worlds which invite me. For half a century I've been writing my thoughts in prose, verse, history, philosophy, drama, romance, tradition, satire, ode, song. I've tried them all. But I feel that I have not said the thousandth part of what is in me. The incompleteness of life here. Another sort of indication that there must be more to it. And a fourth line of reasoning, because of other reasonings all our own. It was Pascal who said, the heart hath reasons of which the mind knows nothing. After they took Jesus away, Mary stood there at the sepulchre weeping. And that describes the way we stand behind here on earth very often. There must be something else, a place where we will meet those whom God has allowed us to love so dearly here on earth. It was Sir Robert Scott's son-in-law, the Lockhart, Scottish poet, who put it this way. It is an old belief that on some solemn shore, beyond the sphere of grief, dear friends shall meet once more. Beyond the sphere of time and sin and fate's control, serene and changeless prime of body and of soul, that creed I fain would keep. This hope I'll not forego. Eternal be thy sleep, if not to waken so. Now, these are just four little bits of reasoning having to do with the idea that it isn't it isn't unreasonable to think about a life after death. These four reasonings are a little bit like the leaves and the branches and the first birds that Columbus saw when he was coming out across the Atlantic there. Now, they weren't the primary navigational aid. He used the sun, the moon, the stars. But it was a little bit of encouragement for him when they began to smell the land. And these reasonings are a little bit like that. They are not our primary navigational aids as far as a life that goes on is concerned. But it's an interesting idea. Our reasonings, however, can be wrong, and we certainly can't navigate by them. What do the scriptures say? Again, it was Gladys Hunt who tells about watching a group of ladies who'd been meeting in a Bible study for some long time, and then one of the ladies died after some long, lingering illness of cancer. And they all looked around afterwards, and they were talking about it, and one of the ladies finally burst out saying, "Why doesn't God do something about it?" And she said, "Bells rang," and I said, "He did." And this is the point here, where we begin to find that in his book, he has said something about it, and then he went on to do something about it. The Old Testament has many, many things to say in it about death. Most people sort of think that the Jews didn't quite get around to this idea. Immortality was beyond them, life after death. And nothing could be farther from the truth. When men make up their ideas about what the book says and then go into it to read it, they very often can find out about it. Just what they expected it would say, they say. Every once in a while, I remember a couple down in Bloomington, we were in a couple study down there, one of the graduate couples. He said, "You know, it sure is good to find out that God agrees with you in some of the things you've been doing through the years." Well, this is the way some people always study the book. And men have made up their minds that the Jews didn't understand very much about immortality, so that's what they found in here. And there are places in the Old Testament where it sounds as though they didn't. Psalm 39 ends with the tears of a man who's wrestling with this problem. "Hear my prayer, O Lord, hold not thy peace at my tears. O spare me that I may recover strength before I go hence and be no more." Well, that man was crying. In the same way that any man who is honest will cry. And God doesn't whitewash men. He paints them in their tears as well as in their victories. That's precisely what he's doing there. He's showing us the wrestling. You go right on into the first verse of the next chapter, and it's the very Psalm 40, verse 1. "I waited patiently for the Lord, and he at length inclined to me and heard my cry," and so forth. Job 7, verse 22, Job says, "For now I sleep in the dust, and thou shalt not speak to me in the morning, and thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be." Just disappear, gone. And he's crying there. He's weeping. He's really wrestling and in pain. And in Job 14, verse 10, he says, "Man dieth and wasteth away, yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he?" The places in the book of Ecclesiastes where it sounds very pessimistic, where it sounds as though the animal dies and the man dies and they both go to the same place. There's no real difference between them. But if you look carefully, you'll find that God is condemning the philosophy of life that lies behind that statement there in the book of Ecclesiastes. That's not the conclusion of the Old Testament. That's where God is saying, "Let me show you what you're talking about. Let me show you how you hurt and how you reason on that." And so he puts it into the book of Psalms, into the life of Job, and into the book of Ecclesiastes. Clear back in Genesis, the 22nd chapter, however, there was a man named Abraham who believed in life after death. The day God told him to take his son Isaac up on a mountain, his only son Isaac, to offer him as a sacrifice. And in Genesis 22 and verse 5, Abraham said to the servant, "Abide ye here, I and the lad will go yonder and worship, and come again unto you." And he knew that he was going to have to bring about the death of that boy at that point. That's what he was thinking. That's what was in his mind. And we know that Abraham was thinking in terms of resurrection that day. We know it because of what God has said also in his word over in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. We're not asked to surmise on that subject. But over in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, in verse 17, God is telling us the thoughts that were in Abraham's mind. He said, by faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And it was not just a general end of the world type resurrection after death that he was thinking about there. Because as we go into verse 8 up there of this same chapter, he's speaking about how by faith Abraham, when he was called, went out, not knowing whither he went. For an inheritance he obeyed. And by faith, in verse 9, Abraham sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declared plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they had come out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their gods, for he hath prepared for them a city. God doesn't leave it up to the fertile imaginations of men even to decide what it was that Abraham was thinking back there then. He goes ahead to tell us what was in his mind of a life that goes beyond life on earth. God teaching us about the meaning of his own book. And this is just the beginning in Genesis, one of the first characters. In the Psalms, God made many other promises on this subject. The 16th Psalm, and God commends this as being the correct attitude. For thou wilt not leave my soul in the grave, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. Thou wilt show me the path of life. And over in Acts, the 13th chapter, in verse 35, God has the Apostle Paul tell us that this reference also refers to the resurrection of Christ. He doesn't leave that to our interpretation. This has to do with the same thing that Jesus was speaking about then when he said, because I live, ye shall live also. The Apostle Paul quotes from that 16th Psalm. He says, now this applies to what happened to Jesus at the time of his resurrection. Thou shalt not suffer thine Holy One to see corruption in the grave. God explaining his own book to us. Again, in Psalm 49, verses 14 and 15, God says, the man who rejects God, like the sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them. On the other hand, the man who has trusted in God, God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. In Psalm 73, God lets us hear a real man of faith. Nevertheless, I am continually with thee. Thou hast holden me by thy right hand. Thou shalt guide me with thy counsel, and afterward receive me to thy glory. Now these were the convictions that God is commending to us insofar as man's attitude through the Old Testament is concerned. None of them are more clear, more strong than Job. In the 19th chapter of Job, after all that time of suffering and pain, Job said, now, I desire that the next thing I say in this next verse here will be written into the rock and leaded there forever, so that we'll carve the words out of the rock and then we'll pour the lead in, and the elements may wear away the stone, but the lead will stay there. Now, here's what I want you to know. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth, and though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. And we cringe at that. And we build our solid copper caskets, and we build our cement covers for them, and we try to seal them so that no water will get in there. But old Job says, I know the worms are going to chew my eyes out. And did I tell you something? I'm going to see my Redeemer, and it's not going to be the eyes of another person. It's going to be my own eyes that will see. And God said, I like that attitude. That's the attitude that I'm commending to you. From Genesis to Malachi, God has told us of a life after death. And one of the best proofs of that was the conversation that Jesus had with Mary and Martha. Mary and Martha weren't theologians. They had come up through their Sunday school and they had listened to the churches and they had studied their Bibles as the Old Testament, Genesis through Malachi. They'd studied it. But there that day when Jesus said to him, you know your brother's going to live, she said, sure, in the resurrection. She believed in a life that went after death. Who said Jesus didn't teach? Who said the Old Testament didn't teach that? They were ordinary garden variety believers, Mary and Martha, just the same that you and I are. And they believed that. Oh, there were a few who argued on that subject, the Sadducees. But what God taught and what they learned was that there was a life after death. Dr. Terence McCartney tells of hearing old Dr. Peyton in the old Scottish church in Bermuda, quoting from the 23rd Psalm. And he tells about how Dr. Peyton laid his hand on the stone pillar there by the side of his pulpit. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, yet will I fear no evil. And that, said he, is the high water mark of Old Testament faith on the subject of death. Willing to go, but wanting to stay. Willing to go, but wanting to stay. And then he walked over to the other side of the pulpit, Dr. McCartney told us, and put his hand on the other side, on the pillar on the other side. And he said, now here is the high water mark of the New Testament faith on this subject. For I am in a strait betwixt two, Philippians 1:23, the Apostle Paul, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better, yet to abide in the flesh is needful for your sake. And that, said he, is the high water mark of the New Testament teaching on the subject of death. Wanting to go, but willing to stay. The Old Testament, wanting to stay, but willing to go. The New Testament, wanting to go, but willing to stay. If there is any difference, I'm not even sure that there is, in the teachings, it's not really a difference. It's just that the people, including Paul and us, have seen him rise and go, and we look forward to that, and we want that, wanting to go, willing to stay. Again, Gladys Hunt, in her book on death, and I'd really commend that book to you, tells how her friend was dying and almost unconscious, and the pastor began to quote from the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." And her friend, who had been semi-conscious for some time, opened her eyes and waved a farewell and then said with real firmness and strength of voice, "And I shall not want," and die. Now that's the thing that God is commending to us, whether it comes from Old Testament or New Testament. That's the attitude that God is commending to us. In the New Testament, especially in Christ's own teachings, having to do with the death and the resurrection, God's made a tremendous additional revelation to us about death and the whole subject of it. I'd like to ask that we turn, in closing here this morning, to John, the 11th chapter, where it seems to me we have one of the most practical teachings on the subject of death. In verse 17, you know the record there, Lazarus had died. In verse 17, Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. There's one other verse that I'd like to read for you just a moment. That's verse 14 and the first of verse 15. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and I am glad." And we don't like to read that way, but it's important that we do it. Jesus said unto them, "Lazarus is dead, and I am glad, for your sakes, that I was not there, to the intent that ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him, He said, the thing that has happened to Lazarus in his dying is a thing that you're going to be glad for, and we're all going to be glad for, because it gives me an opportunity to teach you something about death. Then when Jesus came, he found they had laid him in the grave 4 days already. The Hebrews did not embalm as the Egyptians did. They buried the same day. He was anointed, not really embalmed. Dead and buried there for about 4 days. Bethany was close to Jerusalem, 15 furlongs. Verse 19, many of the Jews from Jerusalem had been there counseling with Mary and Martha for many hours. He's going to rise, he's going to rise. There'll be a resurrection day, there'll be a resurrection day. Martha, in verse 20, went out to meet Jesus. Mary sat still in the house. Different ladies respond in different ways to grief. We don't condemn them, no matter how it is that they respond. And we do have to remember, though, that for 4 days these friends had been counseling her concerning resurrection. And she went out to him, and she said, Lord, if you had been here, he had not died. If you had been here, he had not died. He whom thou lovest is sick, is dying. That was the message that had first of all been sent to Jesus when he was up in the hills. He whom thou lovest is dying. And Jesus had said, and she would have heard that message when the messenger came back from the first visit. Jesus had said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. She's been sitting at home 4 days while Lazarus died, trying to figure that one out. He said, this sickness is not of death, but it's to the glory of God. What does he mean? Now the first thing she said was, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. If you had been here, but since you weren't, you couldn't do anything about it. You could have gotten here. It wasn't that far. You could have. Jesus says to her, thy brother shall rise again. She says, oh yes, that's right, in the resurrection day. And her faith blazed up at that point. That's right, my brother can live. He'll live again. I know that. That's what the doctrine says. Resurrection at the last day, there in verse 24. It was a mechanical response. There is a doctrine of the resurrection. But Christ has something more infinitely personal for her than a doctrine of the resurrection. He has himself for that moment. It's not just a doctrine about the last day. Martha said in verse 24, yes, I know what you mean, I guess. There will be a resurrection the last day. Then the Lord answered her in verse 25, and he said, I am the resurrection. It's not just a doctrine. It's not just an event. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Do you really believe this? And she said, yes, Lord, I have believed. This is not the first time I believe. And Martha has risen to full faith in her Lord. This is what he wants her to do. She's not avoiding the issue. Do you believe that I am the resurrection and the life? She said, I believe that you're the Messiah. But what Jesus is really asking is, do you believe in a resurrection and a fact, or do you believe in me, that I am? And Martha caught that little distinction there, and she answered it right. Yes, Lord, I believe that thou art the Messiah. She limited Jesus in two ways up to that point. She said, if you had been here, but since you're not, since you weren't, you couldn't. And she limited him in time. I know that at the last day you can do something, but it isn't the last day yet, so you can't. And she hadn't intended to limit him. But her faith was not for the here and now, it was for the there and then. And what he said is your faith good for me here now? Physical. But it's when you face temptation spiritual that you need this kind of power. And in Ephesians 1:19, we read something about that. The exceeding greatness of his power, which he wrought in Christ when he was raised, when he raised him from the dead. Which required more power, the resurrection of Lazarus or the resurrection of Christ? There's an interesting one. Which required more power? Lazarus died again from his physical life. Jesus was raised to an endless life with a glorified body. In the Old Testament, the greatest demonstration of omnipotence, it seems to me, is creation. In the New Testament, the greatest demonstration of omnipotence is resurrection. Enoch went from the physical to the spiritual. And in a sense, this is what happens to every Christian. I'd like to give you an illustration which helps to show how this doctrine of resurrection, which must be tied to our understanding as Christians of death, is of practical implications and application. I've forgotten who the old Bible teacher was that used to tell us about how a ship that was sunk, but the minute he mentioned it, I could remember seeing this happen. A ship that was sunk, stuck in the mud, and it will not come loose. If it's stuck in a certain way and the tides are right, sunk in the mud. But at low tide, they'll bring in barges. And they'll float those barges, a whole series of them, all the way around the ship. And then with cables down on the ship or under it, as the tide rises, it fairly sucks that ship up off and out of the muck and mud at the bottom. In a very real sense of the word, this could be an illustration of what the resurrection of Jesus Christ does for us in connection with our understanding of death. God, command your blessing upon every one of us as we walk out of this room to face death. Whether it's our own or the death of a loved one, we know not which will come first. The one thing we know, Lord, is that you've said that this is one event that happeneth to all. And so, Lord, as we walk out of here to face that, make us mindful of the fact that you have done something about it. Make us mindful, Lord, of those many, many places in your book, both the old and the new, which are telling us about your attitudes towards death and explaining it. And then, Lord, help us as we look to your own death and resurrection. And God, I pray that you would bless each one of us as we see that conversation there with Mary and Martha, and how it was that you drew that personal commitment from her. Mary, I am the resurrection and the life. And in me, you will rise again. And then the restoration of Lazarus' physical life as a sort of a little earnest, a down payment, an illustration of the immortality that you've promised to everyone who trusts in you. God, help each one of us that our faith would be for the here and now, not just for the there and then. In the name of Christ we pray. Amen. Thank you.